This is Screen Divers. In this week's episode, we are talking about 1985 neo-noir classic comedy directed by Martin Scorsese, After Hours. This movie is written by Joseph Minion, directed by Martin Scorsese, produced by Amy Robinson, Griffin Dunn, and Robert Culsberry. This movie is starring Rosanna Arquette, Verna Bloom, Thomas Chong, Griffin Dunn, Linda Fiorentino, Terry Garr, John Hurd, Richard Cheech Marin, Cheech and Chong, and Catherine O'Hara. Cinematography by Michael Ballhaus, edited by Thelma Shoemaker, music by Howard Shore, and produced by Double Play Productions. This movie was distributed by the Geffen Company and Warner Brothers. It was released on Friday, September 13th, 1985. It has a running time of 97 minutes, and it was made for a budget of $4.5 million. This movie made $10.6 million, and it won Best Director in 1986 at the Cannes Film Festival for Martin Scorsese. How are you guys? How are you, Ricky?
I am good. How is everybody here in Screendiver Land?
How are you, Steve?
I always have to adopt the name of the person I'm replacing for the day. I'm not sure I can do Steve, but I'm doing well.
Can anyone hear those Steves? Guns.
Oh, okay, we just did that one. I thought, let me just say, I've got to just say right now.
Let me turn around and say. Let me turn around.
What is it? What was the actor he kept saying on that one?
John Polito.
John Polito. I've got to just tell you that it is John Polito. Okay, cool. John Polito.
In this week's episode, we have a very special guest. Michelle Stang is joining us because Steve is playing Rockstar once again. Somewhere in a corner of Germany, people are pumping their fists to his thumping beat. Michelle is one of the great admins over at the Friends of Horror Weekly. She is a very, very difficult person to deal with on a regular basis, but she is also becoming a very, very dear friend.
Aww.
I picked this movie.
Welcome, woo! Michelle, woo!
Welcome, Michelle.
It's been too long.
Should we give it like a large crowd, like a large round of applause? What do you think?
Absolutely, because Chad got this fantastic opening, and I expect it being an honorary member to have some kind of epic intro.
A quintessential question must be asked. Ricky, what is this movie about?
Imagine that you have a really, really boring life and you live in the great city of New York and you decide, tonight I'm going to change it all. Oh, you shouldn't have. Oh, you should have just stayed at home and just watched boring TV because you're about to be the most wanted man in New York.
That's very good.
I feel like it's the epic, like, cautionary tale against booty calls because, you know.
This fucking movie, man. I was rewatching it this morning. This was one of my favorite. It is one of my favorite Scorsese pictures. And funnily enough, it was made because of the result of the previous movie, the movie that came before it. If I know a factoid or two more than you guys today, it's because I bought the Criterion edition of this movie, which, by the way, the moment I posted on social media, a lot of people came out that I haven't spoken to in a while. They came out the woodwork. Like, where did you get that? I just ordered it. Well done. So the idea is that this movie didn't get 3D for a long time. It was available on VHS. You could barely find it on DVD, and the treatment wasn't great. The copy that I got is a 4K restoration from the original negative of Martin Scorsese's personal copy.
Holy shit.
Yeah. The treatment got done by Thelma Shoemaker, which was the original editor as well. And it got approved by Marty. So it was a pleasure. Even the audio track, they restored it, but it's like monaural, so it's the same track across all speakers. You know, if you have a, you know, 7.1, 8.1 system or whatever, and it got treated with Dolby Vision and everything. So the grain is still there. It doesn't look manufactured at all. It doesn't, there's not much artifice to it, but it looks really good and it deserves it. But to go back to why this movie is a result of the previous film that Scorsese directed, three of my favorite movies, Scorsese's movies, and in my top 10 of all time, those three movies are Scorsese pictures. And the other movie, I'm not going to mention the third one because we may do it on the show at some point, is The King of Comedy. The King of Comedy flopped violently to the point in which it almost destroyed Scorsese's career. Studios didn't want to give him the money. It kind of threw all the plans that he had to make Last Temptation of the Christ in the toilet. So he was devastated and he was running out of money after that. He just bought a house. He bought a loft in Tribeca, which is a stone throw away from where this movie takes place. And he didn't have money to renovate this place. So he didn't write this movie, but there's a lot of Marty going into this. A lot of it. Like the sequences that you guys have seen on your last viewing that I completely forgot, which, because it's a hot night, right? And this movie is massively evocative of Hitchcock. There's a lot of nods at Alfred in here. And in a couple of sequences, you can see stuff, very private stuff that happens in the apartment opposite to whatever window is in the background. For example, there's people having sex. And because it's a hot night in New York, you would have your window open. You would have the curtains drawn open. So you would see this. Our protagonists don't even notice the first time, but we see it. And that's the regular thing that Scorsese talks about, that he would see people fuck all the time in the middle of some night, involuntarily. But what are you going to do? It's a hot night. What are you going to do? I asked for us to cover this movie today because it's one of my favorites. So let's get out of the way. Did you guys enjoy this viewing? Who wants to go first?
No, I was going to say, Umber, with your Criterion collection that you have just received, does it have the extra whatever it was that was removed from the original cut?
There's some deleted scenes in there, but I didn't have time to. Don't tell me that you did.
No. I'm just asking because I just want to. I want to know the contents, and I'll talk about that more later on.
Cool. You want to know about the contents, but are you going to talk about?
Yeah, in connection with the movie, but I'll talk about like why.
So you've seen some of the.
No, I have. I've seen maybe 5 or 10 minutes extra footage, but okay. I just from that 5 or 10 minutes. Anyway, I'll talk about it in a second.
To be honest with you, I actually purposely avoided diving too deep into the disc and the special features because it's bordering on feeling long at times. So I wonder if
seen it then, because the version I saw is actually the theatrical cut. So I only saw the 95. I only saw the 95-minute version.
Me too.
Shit. Okay.
So you've actually seen the original cut.
All right. Okay.
So you can talk about that. Cool. All right.
Okay.
Did I enjoy this movie? I did, but it did feel like a Martin Scorsese movie, but it felt he was trying to make a Terry Gilliam movie.
Bang on.
You know, besides, I mean, obviously there wasn't the strange artistic visuals and things like that, but, you know, but it felt, or like he was trying to adapt like a Franz Kafka book. I wish he made more movies. I wish he had made more movies kind of in this vein, because like all the movies of his that I seem to have really enjoyed are the ones like his 70s and... I mean, I like Goodfellas too, but I wish he'd done more kind of bizarre stuff like this.
Did though. That's the thing. Like, people forget. I think he's one of those directors that is much more versatile than most people, not us, obviously, because, you know, this is medium we eat every day avidly. But to most people, he's associated with, you know, gangster films or a period piece of some kind. And usually that flare of violence that runs through his movies as well. But this is actually a good display of his versatility, I think. The thing is, tonally is weird. It's a weird movie. But it is a dark comedy. You know, I could see someone not being amused by this movie, but then I don't hang out with those people. You know, like I find the humor in sequences that some people wouldn't find funny. And I'll give you an example. The character actor that... what's his name? Is it John Hurd, Ricky?
John Hurd.
Isn't he in The Sopranos as well, man?
Yeah, he is.
he plays the corrupt cop.
But more importantly, he was in Home Alone.
Well, yes, he was. Both parents are in this movie, dude.
Yes,
Catherine O'Hara and John Hurt as well. But there's a sequence in which he's, you know, it's full on drama. He's just being told and not even considering the reaction. Griffin Dunne plays a character called Paul Hackett, a word processor, you know, khaki pants wearing, my life is boring as fuck kind of character. And all of this happens because he's trying to, you know, change the mold of every day, of his everyday life. And it's a disaster. But when they're having that exchange, and it's one of the climatic sequences in this relationship in the film, is at the bar, John Hurt finds out that his girlfriend dies. And the moment he starts uttering her name over and over again, it dawns on Paul that it's the woman that he was been trying to date all night. But his reaction is basically him repeating her name over and over again and slamming the bar top. He's got the bar countertop and he's going, Marcy, Marcy.
What's the matter? My girlfriend just killed herself a little while ago. Took some sleeping pills. Jesus
Christ.
Oh, no.
We had an argument. I told her she had to get out of the apartment. It's my fault. God. Marcy.
I find that fucking hilarious, but it's anguish. He's just found out that his girlfriend killed herself, basically. Not to mention the biker dudes at the bar, the Tom of Holland biker dudes at the bar. Their reaction is so heartfelt. He was like, no. Right after they were pinching each other's nipples at the bar. Do you remember, Ricky?
Yeah, but I mean, like, I'll be honest with you. This is a 1980s film that are treating people of that sexual preference as real people. This is a honest portrayal of New York at the time. And it's not for tongue-in-cheek or anything. Even the punk scene that you see is real. Everything about this film is so real, apart from the women.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you know, the gays are treated well, but every single woman in the movie is a fucking lunatic.
Yeah, it
is. And I beg to differ, I got to say, because I think at some point in my life, I dated each and every one of those archetypes.
And we've got to the real reason. Mate, we've got to the real reason why this is your favorite film.
Oh,
fucking nightmare sequences running through my head that actually happened. I relived them as I was watching this movie again.
I mean, I'm going to say I have had nights in, when I was living in London, I have had nights in London very, very similar to this movie.
Exactly. We all did. But I'm sure Michelle did as well, right? But you still?
God, Michelle won't admit to that. I've had nights very similar to this movie going around London for obviously stupid reasons. Mm-hmm. And I feel like London and New York have that thing where even when I was watching it today, because I've literally just finished watching it and jumped on this podcast, I couldn't believe that 3 a.m., 4 a.m., there was a diner still willing to make a cheeseburger. And then I remembered, actually, in London, there has been moments where I've ended up in a bar, in a restaurant, wherever, and just been like, are you still serving food? Oh, I know it's 2 a.m. Oh, you are? That's amazing. I need it right now. You know, this film did bring back a lot of those like memories flooding back to me. But I've got to admit, Umber, I have not met such crazy women like that before. So I would love to hear at least one tale from you that you're thinking of that you have encountered in your youth.
Well, wait a second. You were talking about Club Berlin and how that's, you know, that's portrayed beautifully.
Yeah. Club Berlin. I've been in that situation.
mate, when Kiki Bridges, which is the artist, right, it's tied up to the column in fucking Full Shibari and Orft comes in, I have met a dozen of those dudes. And I met a dozen Kikis. Myself and Annie both included to back away from a situation like that several times. So I can tell you, this movie is a fucking documentary. That's what this is.
The documentary.
Now, about the punk scene, you were saying, you know, first of all, I love the interaction with the bouncer. I absolutely love the interaction with the bouncer. How the bouncer actually, within 2 minutes, takes a liking to Paul, you know, like, but at the same time, it starts with a challenge. It's like, oh, you could try to force your way in here. I love that. But then the punk dude that goes, hey, man, and comes in, that dude is the frontman of Damage, like a seminal punk band. His name is Ted Warner. And also in the club, I don't know if you noticed, I didn't notice, I had to look for it. Martin Scorsese's father is one of the people in the club during the first Berlin, it's Mohawk Night, during Mohawk Night, right? And the guy on the top, it's fucking Marty, man.
Yeah.
Marty's got the spotlight.
That I caught.
It's great.
Which is very similar. It's very similar to King of Comedy, where Martin Scorsese plays, I think it's like the producer on the set of the studio when Robert De Niro comes in. Which I feel like, because this is a little bit of a satire around a Hitchcock film.
Yeah,
I feel like that was the moment. That was his little Hitchcock moment of like, okay, can you spot
in the movie? Yeah,
can you spot Scorsese? Yeah,
yeah. He has a tendency to do it whenever it's kind of, you know, tonally right. You know, he does it in Taxi Driver as well. Actually, you could argue that he has a pretty full on sequence in it, which is the guy who's in the back of the taxi waiting to kill his wife, basically.
His role in Taxi Driver, that moment, is spellbinding.
Yeah.
Whereas this one, and even the one in King of Comedy, kind of feels like a tongue in cheek, like, hey,
it's a little cameo.
Yeah. Can you spot the Scorsese moment? Yeah.
I love the fact that he's actually lighting the scene as well. Like, he's actually literally lighting the scene. I didn't really dive into the special features of the Criterion edition that I got, guys, but I did watch an interview with a very famous, and a shame on me for, I should just get up and get the disc, really, but she's super famous. It's a movie critic, Jewish lady, old Jewish lady. Let me just get it so I can read it off the thing. Wait a second.
You're not talking about Fran Lebowitz, are you?
Indeed.
Okay. Yes. All right. Okay. I wasn't sure. Like,
All
right.
She's amazing. And they spend 18 minutes together, and it feels so fucking natural because they're probably friends. So
I'm sure they are.
Yeah, but they're also they're the same generation as well. Kinda. She may be slightly younger than Marty, but they are still, you know, kind of, and, you know, both of them being New Yorkers as well, there's an entire beat in which the conversation feels like you're just talking to a friend. And I love that. Absolutely love that. There's barely any questioning. And yet there's an exchange about the movie without having a full on question, which is irritating sometimes. And he was talking about basically sliding the scene inside the, because it's an interior shot, right? So natural lighting is out of the fucking question. But outdoors, because he lived in Tribeca, they barely did any scouting, location scouting. The idea is that at that time, looked exactly like that. They didn't have to wait. There's no, he said that there was nobody around that night. There are no bakeries. There's no activity. And it's a dodgy place. It was a dodgy place. He said he made the reference to, you know, anyone like Trivial Criminals, like after hubcaps. That's where you would go to steal hubcaps from any parked car. So that's why there aren't any parked cars on the road either. So it was just the streets are completely cleared.
Prior to that, Soho meant the image in my mind, and this kind of played into the movie, was sinister. Because if you want to steal hubcaps, which I know that, I don't know.
It's always been my priority.
Fran, I'm not sure. But if you want to steal a hubcap, you go to Crosby Street. You go to Mercer Street, you go around that area at night. Because during the day, trucks, open, people get. chaos and traffic. At night, dead quiet, isolated. Every now and then you see a couple in a doorway having some kind of sex thing. Or you go get mugged. Or you beat somebody up. That's what it was. You're taken to Crosby Street and you say, hey, I want to talk to you for a second, and you work them over. Nobody knows. That was Soho to me.
And because of that, he wanted to use natural lights as well, just natural lighting. And they just got some speed lenses, even if it didn't have much money for this movie. And all of the exterior shots are all pretty much naturally lit, which is not easy to do. That's why he had to get fast lenses to do it. But it's, I mean, the movie look doesn't, like Michelle said earlier, the movie doesn't look gorgeous at all, but it's not meant to. And I think the quirkiness that someone like Terry Gilliam, for example, that's a good parallel that you mentioned earlier, would have injected into this, would have pushed that kind of surreal nature of these exchanges into surreal territory. And you don't want that. That's why this movie is still relatable, because it's a fucked up situation, but it's still grounded in the real world. You know?
Did you know that Tim Burton was originally meant to direct this? Did you know that?
No, I didn't.
No, yeah.
I'm glad he didn't.
Yeah.
I'm glad he fucking didn't.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because he did Pee-wee's Big Adventure instead. And I feel like that's one of those things where something not working out is actually works out better. I don't think Tim Burton would have been, he wouldn't have been right. Like,
no.
Tim Burton's absurdity is more whimsical, right? Yeah, and stuff like that. And like this movie's got some dark, dark shit.
Absolutely. And he never strayed into that territory. So he's staying in his lane. You could argue it actually is much, much less versatile than Scorsese. Like, this is to praise Marty here, because at the end of the day, people forget that this man can do comedy, he can do drama, he can do action, he can do everything. He's possibly the most, him and Spielberg are the most serviceable directors of Zoetrope, I think.
It's funny, you've mentioned now two directors that Martin actually exposed this film to before release. And asked their opinion of, basically, it was around the ending. He had a big problem with the ending, like he didn't know how to end it. And it's hilarious because how he thought initially to end it, he went through four or five choices and he just ended up with the same opinion of like, oh, we'll just end it like that. But he asked Brian De Palma, Steven Spielberg and Terry Gilliam all of their opinions.
Well, there you go.
Which is hilarious because of that scene in the bathroom where he looks up and there's Jaws chomping on someone's
penis. Yeah, dude.
And so Steven Spielberg must have been like, oh, that's hilarious. Great. Keep
look,
that.
I posted the photos. You know that the. It's like a stick figure with his dick being bitten by a shark.
Yeah.
Right? Until I bought this this Criterion restoration. Because when you open the case, there's actually like, there's the drawing.
Yep, there you go.
It's right in there. It's amazing.
I haven't got any information on this, but I really hope it was Steven Spielberg who kind of turned up and just drew it himself. Like in my fantasy, it was Steven just being like, you know, it'd be hilarious right now, Marty. Let me just draw this and film that.
we're gonna need a bigger knob.
Oh my god!
I'm sorry. That's all I got. That's all I've got.
We haven't actually talked about. We haven't talked about our history with this film, because normally that's a Steve question. So Michelle, could you ask the question, please?
Do it with a Welsh accent.
Oh my god!
I threw a gun in there as well.
You know I can't do accents, but okay. Ricky, what is your first experience with this film?
Oh, okay. Well, I had actually thought I'd seen this film before, and today was my first viewing. I had definitely seen scenes out of this film.
Oh, look how excited you are.
Yeah. I had seen scenes out of this film. So I saw the scene where he first meets Kiki. I saw that fully. Don't ask me how. I definitely had seen that fully. But as the movie went on, I was like, I don't remember all of these connections. I may have seen the scene with Terry Garr when he enters Terry Garr's apartment, but other than that, no, I think this was my first full viewing of the film.
That's pretty good. I'm glad that regardless of how you feel about this movie, I'm glad that we picked it then, you know, just so solely on those bases. Michelle?
Well, since this movie isn't one of my all-time loves, there's no like definitive memory of, you know, I saw this and loved it. I went through a phase in my 20s where I wanted to be considered like a serious film fan, you know, so I wanted to see all the movies that were considered classics. But all I can remember when I, you know, when you asked me, like, I could only remember like Rosanna Arquette's death and him being like chased around by the mob. I couldn't remember anything else. Like, this is a totally different movie than what I remember watching. A lot of what's funny about the movie
probably hits harder now that we're older.
It's just because the humor is different. Like, yeah. You have to be somebody who's like kind of attuned to that kind of humor to be like, that's pretty fucking funny, you know.
Yeah.
You know,
Marcy, like, Marcy, Marcy.
Well, my thing was like the Rear Window homage, where he's hiding from the mob up in the fire escape, and mm-hmm. he can see in another window where the woman is shooting her lover, and he's like, I'm probably going to get blamed for that too.
Yeah.
You know, it's like,
allowed.
You know.
Which, like, by the way, to our listeners that haven't seen this movie, hopefully this conversation spurs you to go and seek it. But regardless, when Michelle is referring to the mob, she's not referring to a bunch of fat Italian dudes with ties to the mafia. She's referring to a mob of people.
I mean, it is a New York film, so you could confuse it.
I guess.
Yeah, it's like an ice cream truck driving around with a bunch of,
by a Canadian,
know, angry. Yeah.
Yes.
It's just kind of a very strange mob thing where you've got an ice cream truck chase looking for a guy.
You know, this movie is very New York. It really is. And it's evocative. And I think it's also quite influential because it was made in, well, shot between, I think the shoot was fast here, by the way. Marty apparently legendarily shoots, like a regular shoot for Marty is about 90 days, unless something goes wrong. This one was done in much less than that. Yeah. So he likes to work fast. And that keeps budgets down, by the way. So the man's a legend. Doesn't matter whatever the fuck his opinion is about Marvel movies. Sorry, Steve. He's right. So I had to throw it in there because I'm gonna rant about this like over and over again, you know.
Yeah, I feel it.
To have Gen Z on social media going, "Yeah," it's like, shut the fuck up, man. Shut up. We don't give a shit. All right, go watch Captain America. Shut your fucking mouth. All right, leave this shit
mate,
to us, please.
Mate.
Oh, no.
Mate.
No.
I think you're just bitter.
Yeah, I am. I am indeed. And this brings me to another point. Now, that interview that I mentioned earlier, between Marty and Miss Leibovitz, is that her name?
Fran Leibovitz, yeah.
They're talking about, you know, it's a very candid conversation. I suggest that you guys look for it because it's got to be on YouTube. It's 18 minutes.
Oh, I'm sure.
It's joyous. It's great because it's so organically natural. Like, that conversation feels like two friends just meet up for coffee without the cup of coffee between them. And they start talking about, I think it was Leibovitz that says to him, you know, this generation will never understand. And she's right about that. They will never understand the predicament that this man is experiencing due to a series of unfortunate events. The catalyst in this movie, there's several. They're all objects. They're phones, banknotes, doorbells, keys.
Yeah.
Every single object, inanimate object in this, is kind of working against, and the city itself working against Paul, you know. But there's a bit, and I mean, I'm in my 40s, Michelle. You're in your late 20s, and
and I'm in my thousands. I'm in my centuries.
Yeah, but you need to show your skin regimen at some point. Your moisturizing regimen, because beautiful skin,
Ricky,
beautiful skin. You're glowing today, mate. You're glowing.
The thing with the objects is, I felt like the universe was trying to warn him from the very beginning, because his pen wasn't working when she was giving him her phone number, and the pen wasn't working. And then, you know, his money flying out the window. It was like,
yeah,
the universe was kind of saying, don't go.
But in the conversation that they're having, she poses this question to Marty. Do you think this movie could be made today? Marty stops her in a taxi. He goes, yes.
Someone sees After Hours for the first time, and they're young, and actually young, not just younger than us. You would have no frame of reference.
That's right.
For the dilemma he was in.
That's
because
right.
How could you get stranded anywhere?
Right. Yeah.
Why would you need money?
Why would you need cash? Why would you need cash?
Right. Why would you need cash? And why would you need a cab? And why can't you just call Uber? And why do you, you know, or text Uber, whatever.
However, if you take everything that we have today, you could make an updating of this. And with the technology and all the different
aspects. Because it breaks all the time.
It breaks.
Yes.
Something happens with the Uber car, and it just becomes a series of mishaps, and you wind up in a real anxiety dream. You cannot get, you're moving in slow motion, you can't get anywhere. It could happen. It could happen.
I would say, though, that with this film, there is some element about it that is more screwball comedy than it is serious drama. Or it has a lot of satire in it, but it's this, it does weigh a very thin line. And I don't know if it was because of the time it was made, or is it because there's something about the script that they wanted it to be more, not laugh out loud, but more like creeping, like, is this going to turn into a horror film all of a sudden? Is someone going to die again? You know? So
I think it's a happy accident, but at the same time, it's got Marty's flavor all over it. It really does. There's something, you know, don't you think? Like there's shifting gears in the tone that it would have been on the note. But it's also very hard and difficult to replicate. I'll give you an example. On my last viewing, my perception of Paul Hackett, I am much more lenient towards him, because I never noticed how polite this guy is. Like he's actually genuinely polite. Like when he's apologizing to some of the characters he interacts with, it feels like he's meaning it. Yes, he's still driven by lust. He's trying to get laid, but that's fine. He's single. The idea is that it doesn't come across as, there's no subterfuge. I didn't see him as a slimy character. And that's the memory that I have of Paul Hackett until I watched this movie today. When he goes back to apologize to her, he has no reason to do so, but he does, and he means it. He was going to leave again. And you can see it. And I love how subtle that's why it hits harder whenever he snaps in this.
Are you all right?
Where are those Plaster of Paris paperweights anyway? I mean, that's what I came down here for in the first place.
Well, that's not entirely true. I came to see you. But where are the paperweights? That's what I want to see now.
What's the matter?
I said I want to see a Plaster of Paris bagel and cream cheese paperweight. Now cough it up.
Right now?
Yes, right now.
They're in Kiki's bedroom.
Then get them. Because as we sit here chatting, there are important papers flying rampant around my apartment because I don't have anything to hold them down with.
Fine.
It's kind of rude. All of a sudden, he comes across as being very rude. But because it's so much contrast with his khaki pants, ordinary kind of, which, by the way, everything in his apartment's fucking khaki. Yeah. And beige. The watch he's wearing, it's a Hamilton khaki, which is an expensive watch, by the way. So he went out of the way to actually buy that watch because it's the stuff that he likes. There's a fucking painting in his apartment of a chair on the wall. it's, you know.
But I missed that.
But I was going to say, with this viewing that I saw, my only viewing of this from start to end, I would love to know, you know, in a year or so, maybe rewatching it, I'll see like something else in this. But do you think that this is just his fantasy because of how boring his life is? So
Marty, you mean, or Paul?
No, Paul's fantasy. Like, because we have that long, elongated thing where, let's say he went to the diner, he met this girl, and then he went back. But then you've got that elongated scene where he's just, like, channel surfing. He's just using that big remote, and he's just channel surfing.
I got your question. I think it is a fantasy, and I think he's him acting up on it and finding out that he'll never match it. It'll never match whatever. He had aspirations for this night. Several times they get dashed. And funnily enough, another thing, you know that this movie takes place on a Friday. And I didn't ever realize that. It's Friday. The shot when he leaves the office is the two big gates being closed. First of all, it's the last fucking person to leave the office. That's his life, right? Khaki pants wearing Paul Hackett. He's the last person to leave. And as the camera pulls away, it looks like he's leaving jail. It looks like he's being let out of prison, like he's done a term. And I watched that shot today, at the beginning of the movie, when he leaves the office the first time. And I turned around to her and I was like, doesn't look like he's just left prison? And she goes, yeah, because there's two dudes closing the gates behind him. And there's a little bit of a crane shot. It's a Friday and he goes back to work on Saturday morning, which, by the way, I had to go and check.
Oh, see, I didn't know. I didn't Because
I thought it was a weeknight. I thought it would have been a weeknight.
That's how I know I'm old. That's how I know I'm old. Because at the end, when he's going to work, I'm like, I wouldn't, you know, like, there's no way now that I don't care how hot the person is or whatever. There's no way that if I had to work the next day, I would be answering a booty call at almost midnight. Like, I'd be like, let's do this another day.
But he's young. He's
yeah,
young.
Yeah. Like, because I'm like, Dunn fuck was actually, that.
He was actually 30 years old when he took this role. I had to check. He was born in 55. This was made, so he was 29, 30. And he actually looks quite young. No, he doesn't dress young, which, by the way, he dresses horribly in this, even for 1985. His trousers are ill-fitting. It's just ill-fitted or ill-fitting?
Ill-fitting.
And also, I had to check, because, yeah, khaki is the color, the shade that they gave this character, right, for everything that he wears, everything around him. And I looked, the symbology of khaki is reliability, stability, and calmness. That's what khaki stands for. What's the name of the guy that plays Horst?
Will Patton.
There's a lot of little actors in this. Fuck, did you recognize someone from The Burbs, guys?
It was somebody from The Burbs.
Oh, yeah. Is that Dick Miller?
Oh.
Well, Dick Miller, I was looking at him I was looking at his IMDb, and it's like every movie, almost every movie that I love from the 80s, he was in. You know, everywhere. Like Gremlins, Chopping Mall. What else did I have for
There's
him?
There's a lot of stuff.
He's in Night of the Creeps, The Howling.
He gets to say the title of the movie in this movie. In the cafe, He goes, he ends that sentence with, you know, it's because it's after hours. And it's exactly at the 29-minute mark of this movie. And shortly after they say that, they get up and leave, and there's a clock in the diner, and it's 2:20 a.m. So yes, that Michelle, you're right. During but it's a Friday night. So technically, you could argue that, you know, I mean, that age, I used to come back home 2 days later, so.
Yeah, he says different rules apply when it gets this late. You know what I mean? It's like after hours.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So it's like he's telling us what we're going to be seeing the rest of the night. That after hours is a totally different reality.
The guy actually thought about it now. I didn't think about it when I saw him, because it's been bothering me. I did another viewing this morning. And the dude that, you know, when he comes into the diner the second or the third time, and he doesn't have any money. So he has to use the bathroom. The guy goes, it's customers only. You're going to order something. He goes, yeah, I'm ordering something. And just before he leaves again, because when he comes out of the bathroom, the guy set up a table for him. So he's going to get food. That dude, that guy, is the guy that thanks De Niro in Taxi Driver and then keeps beating the shit out of the guy that De Niro just shot in Taxi Driver. Is the shopkeeper. Same character actor. Yeah, so he's recycling a lot of... His mother is in this as well. And you've met her in Goodfellas. She's the old lady that cooks for the three of them or whatever. Bronson Pinchot is in this, the beginning. Well, you like Bronson, right?
Yeah, because I watched, what was the show where he was?
Perfect Strangers.
I watched Perfect Strangers as a kid. Nothing to rearrange. Sometimes you just get a feeling like you need some kind of change. No matter what the odds are this time, nothing's gonna stand in my way. This flame in my heart, like a long lost friend, gives every dark street a light at the end. Standing tall on the wings of my dream, rising. So he's always gonna be. He's always going to be Balky to me.
I wonder how that show comes across now with today's sensibilities. It would be difficult.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure it's racist as hell, but.
I loved it when I was a kid, you know.
Yeah.
As much as Mork and Mindy. I remember watching like reruns of these two shows back to back. But there's a ton of other character actors. There is one thing that it's just a coincidence, but we were talking about Dick Miller. There's another big actor here of a different era, and people may have forgotten, but it's Verna Bloom, I think her name is.
Yeah,
Verna Bloom
Animal
is in one
House.
Of my. Yeah, she's in one of my favorite like 70s westerns with Clint, which was High Plains Drifter. which is one of George's from Horror Weekly, one of his favorites as well. And she's in that.
I haven't seen that yet. I know. Yeah. There's a million things you think I should
see. It's a good one, particularly with the we're not going to reveal it to our listeners now, because there is one thing that George, he made me go back to the movies. Like, he said something, watch it under this lens. And when I watched it again, I went, oh shit, I never noticed that. So I don't want to say what it is. But in regards to her and Dick Miller, they both died in January or November 2019, I think. Both
of them, same month. I actually thought you were going to describe their death like they both died in a plane over Buenos Aires.
But it's a shame. It's obviously a shame, but, you know, people die. What are you going to do? Now, both of them died in January 2019. And apparently they were together in more than one movie as well. Regarding Griffin Dunne, before you came on, Ricky, I was saying to Michelle, I said, hey, you know, I found out something about Griffin Dunne I didn't know. First of all, I knew that he was a writer and director. There's a lot of stuff that he's done, but we've all seen. We're not going to go through it. For any of our listeners, go on IMDb. Do a much better job yourself. But in regards to Griffin Dunne, his sister, Dominique Dunne. Was it Dominique Dunne?
Yeah. She was in Poltergeist. Yeah, she was the oldest daughter in Poltergeist.
Yes, she was. To most people, they may remember her. She was the oldest daughter. What was the name of the family? And that, do you remember?
Oh.
Darlings, the Fairlings or something or whatever. But she got strangled by her ex-boyfriend in 1982, so violent death.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. It's like, why are we talking?
We're talking about this because last year, Griffin Dunne released his memoirs or some kind of thing, because apparently his entire family is kind of famous. So I always liked him. Man, he's the highlight of American Werewolf in London for me.
Like, yeah, me too.
And he has a much smaller part than what you may remember, but I long for him to come on screen every time I watch that movie, because it's the comedic relief, but it's also, it comes out of nowhere when you see him. You know, just the position of having a friend who's a zombie now, it's fucking great. Yeah, it's memorable. It's very memorable to everyone that watches that movie. He also plays, I don't know if you guys watch Frasier at all, but he features in a Frasier episode where he plays like a dude on a wheelchair, and due to retro signaling or whatever, Frasier decides that he's going to make friends with this guy, but then he tries to, you know, exit the friendship, and that's when things go wrong. But it's Griffin Dunne plays this dude on a wheelchair. It's phenomenal. So if you remember this, go and seek it. It's on Amazon, I think. You'll find it there. Catherine O'Hara.
Oh my gosh. That would have been when I snapped, when he's trying to call somebody and she's just rattling off these random numbers. I was saying like to myself that like that's when I would have I would have lost it then, you know, because of all that I had gone through. And then this woman's like intentionally trying to thwart my attempts to go home.
Manhattan, please. Could I have the number of a Peter Patzik? That's P-A-T-Z-A-K.
Need a pencil?
No. On Mulberry Street. Thank you.
5-8-1-9-6-2.
That was funny. That was funny. Just... Patzik, please. P-A-T-Z-A-K on Mulberry Street in Manhattan.
Thank you. 5-8-6-2.
Don't.
9-3-8-0.
Now I have forgotten the number. What is wrong with you? Are you all right? I have had a terrible, terrible night. Do you understand?
I'm just trying to entertain you.
I don't want any entertainment. I'm sorry I did that. I'm sorry. I'm under... Oh, God. I'm unable to get home tonight, you know? I can't get home. And I'm trying desperately to find a place where I can stay tonight. Just sleep. All I want to do is sleep. There is a place on Spring Street. I could stay there, but I don't want to.
Yeah, why not?
Why not what?
Why aren't you there? There's a place on Spring Street. Go.
Because a bartender who lives there, his girlfriend, killed herself tonight. And I think it's because of me.
I see. That's out then.
That's right, that's out. That is out. That is not a possibility. So if you just let me make this phone call, you'd be doing me such a favor. You really would.
Please. I can wait. I hurt your arm, and now I want to dress your arm, please.
You know, when he meets her, she's wearing yellow. She's got a yellow, like, alert kind of top on. And on top of that, she has a massive whistle around her neck.
Yeah.
We don't know what she's going to do with it later. But that's, it's prominent. So you'll see it. Because it's like, as soon as I saw, like, I turned around to Anne and I went, is that a whistle around her neck? And mm-hmm. she's wearing yellow.
Well, it's a rape like, whistle. It's yeah. a rape whistle.
It is. But there's no conversation, like, referring to that at all. So
yeah.
he meets characters that are increasingly sanding, like a... an hazard kind of signal of some kind. It's like danger. You know what
yeah.
I mean? I think the four women that he gets involved with in the movie are blonde, all of them. And I think this is another nod.
No, Kiki's not blonde.
But Kiki doesn't get romantically involved with Kiki. It's just a second and it's a joke. But with each and every of the, like with the other four women in the movie, he basically tries to get laid until something changes. It's he has a romantic moment with Verna Bloom and she's a blonde, even if it's, you know, like a hash blonde or whatever. There's Terry Garr and she's blonde, Catherine O'Hara and she's blonde. But I mean, you could argue that he goes upstairs to, but he doesn't go to Kiki's house to see Kiki. He goes to Kiki's house to see Rosanna
yeah.
Marcy. Marcy, that's her name.
Yes.
Yeah.
But like, again, this is why I kind of lent on, this must be a fantasy, because in every scenario and every situation, the women are hitting on him. And he's trying to be the charming guy, but inevitably in every single scenario, he gets into a predicament where he goes, oh, no, I can't deal with this. No, this person's too
yeah,
much.
But they're all crazy, though.
Yeah,
they're
but,
all fucking crazy.
Yeah, like, that's my point. There isn't actually a sane woman in this film. And it's actually
but you
a
know
little
that there
bit...
are crazy people out there. There are also boring people like Paul Hackett out there.
Yeah, but that's the thing. That's why I think that this is sort of like his fantasy. Like, let's say that the film actually really is him just sitting on the couch watching TV. And the fantasy moment is like, maybe I can just go out and maybe I can meet these people. And he's actually telling himself, if you go out, this is what's going to happen. If you go out, this, and then you're going to be set up for
murder.
So
you think it's a fantasy through and through,
yeah.
or you
yeah,
think
yeah.
it's the contrast of the fantasy that it's not?
No. I really think this is a fantasy.
So you think he falls asleep on his couch as he's
yeah.
channel surfing with his massive fucking remote control?
Yeah, the old school 80s remote. Click, 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 click. I'm connected to cable TV. Click, 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 click.
I want one of those, man. I want one of those, like with fucking veneer, like wood on the sides.
And
it looks like an Atari 2600. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but in a way, I would love it if that is the real thing. If it is, because I would be more accepting of everything that happens to him, including the minor argument he has with the bouncer that leads to him almost getting a mohawk shaved into his head. All of it leading up to the fact, or like the fact that the one bar that seems to be open on that street happens to be connected to Marcy, who he's just found out has, like, killed herself, it would be... I think I would accept this film a lot more if it was a fantasy. And I'm actually glad I can have that opinion, that it's not... There's nothing that's forced upon you in this film.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's plausible, right? And in fact, you said it as well. They didn't know how to end this movie. So it must have passed through their minds, right? At some point, it's like, do we make this a full-on fantasy or not? You know, that it just does. He goes back to work the following day. That's it. Back into his routine. In regards to little details, things that, you know, because I haven't seen this in a while as well. And I noticed this. The pills that Marcy takes, Rosanna Arquette's character, on the bottle, and we get like a full-on, again, a lot of objects get center stage here. His watch, clocks, the money. And I love it. I love this because these are inanimate objects and they're catalysts. There's almost like a power that they exude. You know what I mean? Like it's the keys at one point, more than one time are menacing in this. When Kiki throws the keys, if you ever caught a bunch of keys the wrong way and gravity was behind them, they hurt when you catch them. So the moment he takes that step back, it's kind of believable. But it's again, like Michelle said earlier, it's a warning. He gets warned by these objects. Like, don't you know, don't go in there kind of thing. And he does. He fucking goes back for more. But why? And this is the thing that I thought of today. It reminded me of, which I can't remember if Michelle hated it or not. I loved it regardless. Speak No Evil. The original Speak No Evil.
Oh, I mean, it's kind of a one and done movie, but I thought it was brilliant.
It is. And the thing is that what I picked up from that movie is how bad of a situation are you going to get yourself into just because you don't want to be rude? So I'm not saying that people should be rude, but when it gets to a certain point, you need to remove yourself from a situation, right? If you don't want to be rude, because if it gets to the point in which you need to be rude and you're not, then how far are you willing to take it to be fucking polite? Because that's what that movie's about. It's about, you know, and that's why a lot of people didn't get it. But that was the message as well. There's an anti-fascist message, you know, historical connotations behind Speak No Evil. They're rooted within Danish culture as well. But when it comes down to this movie, he gets himself in these situations because he's being overly polite. So that's why I said the contrast of when he snaps, it's like, you're an asshole. It's like, no, not really. You know, you should have, but he's also young. He's like 29, 30, whatever it is. You know, and if you have a boring life, maybe you don't have just the tools to deal with the shit. They're unusual situations.
Yeah, I think I when I was watching it, I think I would have gotten to a certain point with Rosanna Arquette too, because she was, I don't want to say she was a dick tease, but it was like one minute she was all excited and stuff and was like, this is going to be the best night. And then the next minute she's oversharing about having been raped. And one second it's like she wants to be, you know, she gives him this hope when he takes her hand and stuff. And he's like, yeah, it's happening. And then when he kisses her, she starts, you know, to cry. I think he got to a point where he was just, this isn't happening. And I'm sick of the games and I'm out of here.
He's still driven by lust.
Well, yeah.
Thing. Yeah, because otherwise you would have gone, you know what, if you met this person and you really liked them, just fucking go home now. Deal with it another night. Try it another night,
yeah.
or another date or whatever and see how that goes. But no, he goes back for more. And it's immature, almost, I would
argue. And when she's dead, and you initially think, oh, because she has that book about being burned. So you think, oh, okay, he's just checking to, you know, because he was curious about the burn. And then it's like, no.
I'm glad we are given the story. When he tells Kiki the story, which, by the way, she falls asleep. That's fucking great. When she leans her head back and he thinks, I'm getting some now. So she's asleep. I fucking loved it. But that exposition they were given, because otherwise he's just a superficial prick, right? You would have thought, that's what I remember. I forgot about that little story and how that was childhood trauma. So he's terrified. He doesn't like the idea. It kind of justifies having phobia almost, right? But you take that story away, he's a superficial prick. Who gives a shit if she's got a scar? You know what I mean? But he's got some childhood trauma thing. We all have something, and that's his.
You know who else thought he was a bit of a superficial prick? Hi, how we doing? We all good?
Welcome, Mrs. Bader.
Hey, so we've got 2 1-star reviews.
Uh-oh.
And the first one says, too much bad stuff is happening to this guy. From 15 minutes, weird and bad stuff begins to happen and it gets bothering. Well-made and well-acted movie, but has this thing that made my experience worse. Thank you, Butskinskids. January.
Sorry, what?
Butskinskids. Thank you from January 5th, 2019. And the next one, this one is almost poetic. It is split up by a lot of full stops, but and paragraph marking, so let's go with this. Another 1-star, a waste of time. This film is torture. Griffin Dunn is unbelievable. He trips from one disaster set up to the next. They are all intercut with each other. Rosanna Arquette is a beautiful girl he agrees to meet. Then a lot of wacky coincidences fill up the rest of the movie. Terry Garr is surprisingly stilted, as there's no knockers to bounce off in this movie. So it's hardly her fault. Now that I've watched it again, I now remember the last time too. It's still as pointless. An endless line of stuff happens to poor Sap. Then he gets literally dropped off back at work the following morning. It all must mean something. No one really does anything wrong acting-wise. It just seems to be missing an excuse to exist. Did they have a lot of film stock they needed to get rid of? A long list of visuals. Well shot. Shame it was a total waste of time. Martin Scorsese could not figure not a suitable ending for this film, it says in the trivia section on here. It shows torture, and even worse, pointless torture. Thank you, Professor Mouse, June 26, 2025.
Fuck you, Professor Mouse. Fuck you.
Fuck you, Professor Mouse.
Fuck you, James Spader,
for giving a platform to the loud minority.
Like an Animaniacs character or something like that, Professor Mouse. Like.
Right. My experience with this movie at the end of the episode.
Yeah.
Now, as you guys know, Italians are notorious for, it's happening less and less, but they were notorious in the 80s, the 90s, the 70s, the 60s for dubbing. Well, not just Italians, the Germans do it as well, the Spanish do it as well for dubbing movies, right? And this also means altering the name of movies on posters or whatever. I'll send you the copy of the poster for this because I found it. The title of this movie, it's an anomaly because it's fuori orario, which means out of hours, which is close. You know, it's very close. Like, usually that alteration is not a literal translation. You know, like I could tell you that like Evil Dead is called La Casa in Italian, which is like the house. The house. Yeah. And the first time I saw this, I had the same intent that Michelle had when she was in her early 20s, which was, holy shit, I like this. I want to know everything about this, and I want to be insufferable when we talk about movies. So I'm going to watch as many movies as possible. And I think I've achieved that. I'm insufferable. So,
yeah, that's the difference. I stopped being one of those.
I don't know. If you're here, you're fucking insufferable.
Well, all right. I meant the insufferable good movie snob. Like I know I'm still insufferable, but I stopped being the pretentious. I stopped being the pretentious movie snob.
Right, Ricky, I sent it to you. Michelle, I sent it to you now. Take a look. It's it's similar, but you've got to give it to the Italians. We had a lot of artists that I think there was a bunch of Germans as well that were very prolific in Italy because it was that era in which they would be drawn. Posters would be drawn. They would have that hyper-realistic kind of style, but I miss that era. I love those posters. If you look at the poster, it's very evocative for that decade. You see it?
Which leads me to another fact around Rosanna Arquette, which is she didn't like her feet. And she still doesn't like her feet. So she actually said if her feet needed to be exposed on film, she would rather have a double for her feet. So it's funny that there are posters like that with Rosanna Arquette lying down with her feet in the air because she's like, I'd never do that.
No, but it's not a photo, right?
No, it's not a photo, but that's the amusing thing that Rosanna Arquette...
Am I going to spend the rest of the afternoon looking for fucking pictures of Rosanna Arquette's feet? Why are you destroying my fucking algorithm?
You can go to WikiFeet. I mean, now, you know, people
my God,
have,
what?
You know,
what?
Yeah, you know there's like IMDb.
No,
for
I don't
cars.
Know. I don't want to hear it. I don't want to hear it. No.
Go look at WikiFeet. WikiFeet, yeah.
What's WikiFeet? They rate them.
They rate feet. Celebrity feet.
Oh my God.
That's your whole afternoon.
Can you see if you can find Rosanna Arquette's feet?
Yeah, I did already.
Are there pictures?
Yeah, there are. From like,
can you send me pictures of Rosanna Arquette's feet?
No, you research
yourself.
Because
I don't want to fuck up my algorithm,
dude. You start on WikiFeet. You are going to go on a deep dive. You are going to go. And funnily enough, it's not like as it's not as
Michelle,
seedy
did you
as
know
it
about
sounds.
This? Did you know about WikiFeet? There's a thing called WikiFeet.
Are you being an asshole on purpose?
I'm telling you, he's just told me now. He's just told me that the poster that I sent you, Rosanna Arquette, she's being drawn with her feet up, and apparently Rosanna Arquette doesn't like her feet. Michelle, can you hear us? Shit, can you hear us? Tell her to drop out and back in.
Drop out, drop back in. Umber says.
Okay, leave and come back. Okay.
While I enjoy WikiFeet. Oh.
Did you send me a picture?
If you want, I'll just send you the... Like, no, I'm not going to send you the picture. I'm just sending you the site, mate. Here you go.
No, don't fucking do that. I'm not doing it.
Mate.
I don't want to... You like feet?
No.
It's just... Mate, we're friends. It's all right. We're not recording.
I'm not.
We are recording, but...
Yeah. Oh, okay. We are recording. But no, I'm not.
But do you like feet?
I like standing on my own feet. I don't have a fetish towards it, but I am going to send it to you. Because,
yeah,
you know,
aesthetically,
you
mean, do you like
okay.
feet?
I'm not Tarantino.
Why did I come back now? Why did I come back now where you're like, do you like feet?
It was a teenage wedding and the old folks wished them well. You could see that Pierre did truly love the mademoiselle. And now the young monsieur and madame have rung the chapel bell. C'est la vie, said the old folks, it goes to show you never can tell. They furnished off an apartment with a two-room robot sale.
Okay, Michelle.
Am I better now?
Yeah, we can hear you now. The picture that I sent you, the Italian poster, is basically a drawing. And in that representation, you can see Rosanna Arquette's feet. And Ricky was telling us that she apparently, Rosanna Arquette notoriously never liked her feet. Yeah.
Huh.
And I went, oh, now I want to see Rosanna's feet. I want to see if that's a personal thing or if there's something wrong with them. Ricky goes, why don't you go to WikiFeet? I'm like, to what? He goes, WikiFeet. Like, what the fuck is WikiFeet? It's like it's a site where there's a celebrity feed in there. And I don't want to fuck up my algorithm. So I'm not doing a search here on this computer. I'm not doing it. And on top of that, I don't want to spend the rest of the day looking at feet. I don't want to do that because I'm going to do that. So I asked Ricky to send me a picture of Rosanna Arquette's feet, which is equally weird, to be honest.
Am I going to get this picture too?
Click on it. Click on it. Ruin it. Ruin your algorithm. There's nothing wrong with her feet, but she doesn't like her feet.
There is nothing wrong with her feet.
There's nothing wrong with her feet, but, you know. But, yeah, there's a rating system. Out of five, people have rated it a 4.6.
Her feet or the movie?
Her feet.
Guys, okay, to our listeners, yes, go on WikiFeet. Look. And this episode is brought to you by WikiFeet.
By Tarantino.
All right. Oh, okay. Celebrity crush, Michelle.
Current or any?
Any.
Ooh, probably my all-time biggest crush was Corey Haim back in the 80s.
I'm not fucking doing that on my phone. You do it on yours. You go on your browser and you type in
Corey. I don't care about his feet. I don't care about
his feet. Isn't he dead?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Yeah. His feet, the memory of his good-looking feet will live forever. Just look and see if you can find...
Okay, I'm gonna look it up just because I'm curious about his rating.
Oh, my Corey God. You're not going to find Corey Haim's feet.
You never know. Feet. All right. This is content. Content, everybody. 4.1 out of 5.
You're joking. Are you actually looking at a picture of Corey Haim's feet?
Yeah, he had it. And, it's a shame because...
Mate,
it's a very
he died a long
picture.
Time ago. What the fuck is curating this?
I don't know.
There's some real...
I don't know how they got it.
Is it from a movie or just like
internet?
There's some shot like personal shots as well as some candid shots from magazines as well.
Oh, okay.
Send the link to Michelle.
Oh my God. All right, let's do you.
God.
What
the
who's
fuck,
your
mate?
Go on, celebrity crush. Let's WikiFeet them. Go on.
Mine.
Yeah.
Come on.
Kate Blanchett.
Okay. Oh, very good choice. All right. She has got a 4.83.
Whoa.
Out of 5, right?
Oh, yeah. Ooh.
I know. The question is, can you feed them in your mouth? That's the...
Oh, and you know what? There's an image from a movie where Tarantino would be proud. She's lying on her back and her feet are sticking up and there's like a full...
And the question is, would Kate prefer peanut butter, mayo,
No, that's a question
pate,
for you. What would
sauce?
You like between the toes?
All of those things together.
I love you so much, can't count all the ways I died for you, girl, and all they can say is, he's not your kind. You'll never get tired of putting it down, and I never know when I come around who I'm gonna find. Don't let them break up your mind.
Truffle sauce. Truffle sauce.
I'm
sorry,
oh
Annie.
Oh my gosh.
All right, okay. I can do a ton of it. I definitely. I don't have truffle sauce in the house. I've got some caramel sauce, though. Carnation caramel sauce. Sorry.
On that note.
I think it's ratings times.
Yeah.
Who wants to go first?
I'll go first. I'm going to give this 8 wanted posters. Even though I really enjoyed the humor, and we never really talked about Cheech and Chong, like Cheech and Chong were my favorite. They were my favorite parts, you know. Even though I found it really funny, and I love movies that are about the absurdity of life, I don't know that I'm going to rewatch this. I don't know. There's just something that just, it's not a Michelle movie, I guess. It's and even though it reminded me of a lot of movie directors and movies that I do like there was just something, I don't know if it's just how unlikable the characters were or something, but it just, yeah. So that's why it's not higher, because it's not something that I'm going to come back to and watch over and over again.
8 is pretty high, Michelle.
I mean, it was an excellent movie. Like, it was still, and I do, like, if I was going to rewatch any of Marty's movies, like, this would probably be something that I would revisit before I would revisit, like, what that Flowers of the whatever moon that, I forget.
I actually like that movie.
I mean, I did, but it was really fucking long. So, yeah, I would rewatch this before some of his other movies, but, but it's not, yeah, it's just not a Michelle movie.
Fair enough. Ricky.
I am at a bit of a dilemma with this film because I think I wanted to like it more than I did. However, it's not, as I've always said, if it's below a 5, I'm never going to watch it again. I'm going to give this one a 6.9. And the reason why I'm going to give it lower than I feel like I should is because the relation to this film to King of Comedy. King of Comedy is my favorite Martin Scorsese comedy. I adore it to bits, and I can't wait that at some point in the future we will cover it. But this one didn't match to the whimsy and humor that I thought it would do, especially after King of Comedy. After finding out about the production history and finding out that because King of Comedy didn't do well, it's no wonder Martin Scorsese kind of took a slightly different turn to the way he presented on this film compared to King of Comedy. Again, acting was superb. The character actors were great. There was just something about the script that missed for me. It might be that all the women are crazy in this film, which, mm-hmm. you know, I feel like the character development in this film might be better if I saw the original cut, which it sounds like Umbar did watch. But because I watched a 95-minute version, I am willing to give this film a try again, maybe in half a year, maybe in a year. I would love to see the original cut. But for me, it's a 6.9 bullets to the chest of an unsupportive lover.
well done. I'll be honest, this movie has gone down in my original estimation a little bit, and for similar reasons to the one you listed, Ricky. King Comedy was neck and neck with this, and it's now higher, actually. I think there's because there's allusions to mental illness of some kind in here, or just some dysfunction, you know, like it's in this movie, and you can't take them seriously. You can't, even the craziness, like it's non-offensive. I don't think it could have come across as a misogynistic approach to having all these women being so irrational throughout the movie. But it's in a different vein. I think it's kind of like, I don't want to use the word quirky because that implies whimsy, and there's very little that here. There is a quirkiness, but it's so embedded in this darkness of the city. It tonally is very difficult to identify with this movie faults. And on this viewing in particular, I found if I was to focus on the tone, it was almost unnerving because I didn't want to shift my position on this movie too much. So I still think it's one of his greatest, and it's one of the most underrated films that he's made. It's also a display of versatility for Marty. And I rated it a 7.5, which puts King of Comedy at an 8 now. Yeah, 7.5 what? 7.5 paperweights shaped like bagels. And on that note, this was Umba.
This is Steve.
That is Steve and Ricky.